Welcome to the IT Babble podcast, where we talk about educational technology and a whole lot more. You can find our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe, or your very favorite podcasting app. Also, you can find our blog at www.itbabble.com. Welcome back, everybody. It is the IT Babble podcast. It's here at the end of July. Tony, I am recording in the great state of Arkansas again. We're here visiting friends and family. Where you, sir, are repatriating back to North America. You've got family in Kentucky, family in Canada. Where are you at right now?
I'm in Texas right now. I think this is the first time we've been on the same time zone in a long time.
In a very long time. Yeah, that's right. We're central time zone for a change. Yeah. I'm only going to be here for a week, and then I'll be back to Indiana, and then we'll be different time zones, but only by 1 hour, which is going to be awesome. It's going to be freaking awesome. So we are going to talk.
Is Indianapolis an Eastern time or Central?
It's Eastern.
It's surrounded by Central.
So here's the thing, man. This is a bit of a history. It goes back and forth in Indianapolis, and I'm not going to spend too much time on it because I don't know all the history of it. Indiana has been Eastern time zone and has been all of Eastern time zone at some time. And I think partly Eastern, sometimes Central, and then sometimes they adhere to daylight savings times, and other
sometimes
times
they
ignore.
Don't.
It's weird. It's very weird. It's very weird. All I know is that driving from Indianapolis down to Little Rock, we do have to go a little bit west, and then we go south. I think within an hour of leaving Indianapolis, we were on Central time zone. So there you have it. There you have it. We're going to talk about a SIM card nightmare, which very quickly, we were going to talk about last episode. Last episode has not published because there are some audio difficulties.
And I asked Patrick just to forget it. It's fine.
I'm going to put it on there just because, I don't know, it's a challenge. I want to try to do it. We're going to talk about ambient privacy. Interesting. Interesting. Depressed online. Man, depressed online. I got a story. But anyway, but first we're going to talk about scheduling because it's the summer and IT people like you, Tony, and like me, we are in the midst of scheduling for the next school year.
Few points to make. Like I do quite a bit of scheduling. I fell into doing it a long time ago. I'm by far not the best person I know. I know some people who are just amazing at scheduling. But the one thing I am good at with scheduling is being organized. So here's my only point. Like, software, it's not going to save you, and it's probably not going to help you unless you're organized. And you've got to plan your schedule out first. Like, whiteboard, big whiteboard, lots of data, lots of information, a lot of notes. You've got to plan it out. You've got to know what you're doing. You can't just hope the computer comes up with some solution for you. I always hear people say, oh, well, maybe the computer will. I'm like, if you're using something like Power Scheduler that can make simulated schedules, it'll kick out something interesting. But for the most part, you want the software to save you time when you're putting the students into their classes. You don't want it to make decisions for you necessarily, not huge decisions. Like, you need to know, how many classes any teacher can teach in a row before they get a break. You've got to know that stuff. You lock that down. You don't let the computer roll the dice on that. You need to know who's teaching part-time, who's teaching in high school and middle school. You need to know all this stuff. And all that needs to be planned out first. If you have all that planned out, you can get stuff done very quickly. But what I see people do is they sit down and they like make schedules. Like, I think this would be a great schedule to have. But they haven't looked at any of the constraints, around their organization. And everyone's like, oh, we're a private school. We don't have any constraints. You have constraints. Everybody has constraints,
yeah.
And you also have to look at just logical things. Like, if you're at a school where kids are in high school and they get to choose their classes, well, you can easily have a situation where kids sign up, and then you sit down and do the schedule, and let's say, Patrick, let's say you always taught like these four electives, and this year, none of your electives are popular. And you don't teach a core class. You just teach electives, and none of them are popular. So you what? You have one class, and everybody else has five?
Yeah. Or you maybe have five classes with, six students in each class.
You've got these things are big, big problems, and they're only really worked out ahead of time. If you get into your scheduling and you're like, oh, wait, nobody signed up for any of Patrick's classes, and signups are over, and you didn't give yourself enough time to go back and find something else for Patrick to teach, now you've got to bring Patrick in and say, hey, Patrick, it looks like 10 years ago you taught social studies. How do you feel about that? And that's actually a common problem.
That's real. And I got to say, for scheduling purposes, you mentioned Power Scheduler, which is for Power School. My school uses a different system called BlackBod. And we're not promoting either of these. This is just our experience. And BlackBod, and I'm a small private school, so we can pretty much manually do it very easily. But BlackBod does have systems for larger schools. But it was meant to, put the teachers in with their requirements, put the students in with their requirements or requests, and then start going through manually. That's the idea, is that it does like 90% of the work for you, but then you have to go through it and clean it up the last 10%.
Yeah, so let me just give you an idea of like something that people don't think about in terms of their planning and why they're doing scheduling in July and when August starts. So I use Power Scheduler as a fairly popular product because it is like an engine. It's like its own little like scheduling engine, and it does simulations, and so it's a really good way for you to like look at different ways to make your schedule. But after you feel like the schedule's made, one of the things that you need to do, especially if you are dealing with high school students, is you start in grade 12 and you look at every grade 12 student schedule. You look at all of them, and I actually print them all out. This is one of the only times I print them all out, and I have three piles. Number one is normal. Number two is this is okay, but we can probably do it better. And number three is there's no way the student can actually do the schedule. What do I mean by that? Well, you have to know your kids. Like, yeah, we put all your requirements in and the computer gave you everything you wanted. But, we know that maybe you have maybe your ability in the English language is lower than your classmates. And this is giving you English and world history back to back on the same day before your study hall. Well, you're probably going to fail one of those because they're both heavy essay classes. And we did tell PowerSchool, hey, don't do this, like split this up. But it couldn't find another way to do it because you were taking like band or something. And so it stuck you in that situation. And yes, you can take it, but you shouldn't. And that's like pile number three. That's with grade, especially grades 11 and 12. Grade 9, you're a little bit more flexible. They don't have as many options. And grade 10 is somewhere in the middle. I would say about, 20% of grade 10 kids need to look really hard at the choices that they've made. But see, you already know what choices they've made because you had this process before and you spoke to them about it and you had meetings. This is months and months of work.
Yeah.
And if you haven't done that pre-work, and then when you're finished, if you haven't printed everything off and looked at it and studied it, and some people are like, oh, let's print the schedules off and give them to the teachers. And No. It shouldn't, in my opinion, it shouldn't leave the room. Like, the teachers have to teach whatever they have to teach, and the students have to go to class. So they get their schedules in August. I think that's great. If you start giving people stuff in June, May and June, you need to be ready for the whole summer because all you're going to get is complaints.
Now, that's not to say that you shouldn't show this to principals or division heads ahead of time.
Correct.
Who are curriculum coordinators,
all those people.
Yeah, these people, the coordinators, definitely these people need to see this in June, in July. And that's when they need to see it too. They don't need to see it in the second week of August when school is starting in a week or in 2 weeks. No, they need to see this soon, even if they're not even working. even if contractually they're not working, they still need to see this and to think about, you know, they have to. There's just no way around it.
And I always bring in head of departments, sit them down and say, okay, this isn't the schedule, but this is one version of it. What do you think?
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
And it's just a top down view, and just let them look at it. And sometimes they see stuff that I haven't seen, but I would never give them their actual schedule until August. And so anyway, that's my two cents. It's just mostly about being organized, and you don't need software at all. There's courses. I think the Pearson Master Schedule Building Seminar is a great course. I'm not pushing Pearson, but it's a great course. Yep. It teaches you how to schedule on a very high level manually.
I will say that Blackbaud also has a course about scheduling, and it is garbage. and I'm not pushing Blackbaud, or I'm not saying anything bad about Blackbaud, because Blackbaud does a lot of things that are really, really, really good. But their course, and it's a 3-hour course, it's just very general. It's very, very general. You can probably figure out most of it on your own or talking with another school who has similar experience. And that would be way more beneficial than actually signing up for their 3-hour, $350 course. To be honest, it's very general and it's very basic, and it'll point you in the right direction, but it's not going to give you any concrete answers about anything you really need.
Right.
Yeah.
The Pearson course takes 3 to 4 days.
Oh, okay. There you go. There's a big difference.
Okay. And it's worth it. I think it's really worth it. It'll just change your whole perspective on how you get organized.
All right.
So I do highly recommend it for anybody who does scheduling at all.
Okay. Well, there you go. The Pearson thing. Now, I will say that Blackbaud's online support is not bad. And when you come to them with a specific question, they're usually pretty good about getting an answer. But the Pearson thing sounds like a great way of just approaching scheduling.
Yeah, it's just planning, getting organized. And they teach you how to do it on a big whiteboard, like manually. And I think it's great.
That's really good. I know. I mean, we're a small school, and I know that our division heads for early childhood, lower school, and middle school had spent, and I'm not joking about this, had spent months working on their schedule, trying to make it all work out.
I've used these Pearson techniques like countless times. Like, it's not just about scheduling the whole school. Like, I've used them in the middle of the year to figure out how to squeeze more time into something. It's not just about making your schedule, for the start of the year. It's about being able to manipulate your schedule once the school year starts, because you're going to have problems.
Of course. It doesn't matter how small or big you are. You're going to have issues. You're definitely going to have issues.
Yeah, especially if you have shared facilities.
Yeah, and at a small school, the basic scheduling seems very simple, but when you have your PE teachers teaching every level,
right,
then it becomes tricky. Like, how long is their class? And if their class is slightly shorter or longer than a normal class, well, then how do you block that out? It's tricky. It's not easy. It's not easy. Yep.
Yep. So anyway, that's it. That's all I got to say.
Good. Avoid Blackbaud training. Go to Pearson training and talk with the people who are stakeholders early on. I think that's I oversimplified it.
Good summary.
That's good. All right, thank you. All right, so our second topic is about SIM card swap. I'm going to change that to SIM card swap nightmare.
You've been really passionate about this. You've been wanting to talk about it for a few weeks.
I am, because this guy, okay.
I'm ready just to comment.
Whew, okay. So I first found out about this on ZDNet where this is Matthew Miller, and I think he goes by Millar, not Miller, but Millar. Anyway, he's a tech journalist, all right? And he has been for a long time. He's been a journalist for a very long time and a tech journalist for, slightly less time. So what happened was around 11 o'clock one night, his daughter... And his daughter is like, university level or beyond. She's grown. She just happened to be at home, woke him up, and goes, I think your Twitter account had been hacked. And he picked up his phone, and he found that he had a note on his phone, like a pop-up note that said, your SIM card is no longer valid.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah. So he used his wife's phone, and he called T-Mobile in this particular case. And it turned out that somebody had impersonated him and said, oh, I got a new SIM card. Switch my account over to this phone number. And T-Mobile did. I mean, obviously, they had social engineered him to a point to where he could answer some questions. Maybe billing address, maybe phone number, I don't know. Bank account information, I don't know. But they had got it, and so what they did with that is they were able, because he had two-factor authentication for his Twitter account, they were able to control his Twitter account, gain control of it by resetting the password. Because two-factor authentication for mobile phones, what will happen is you'll say, yeah, I need to reset my password. They'll send your mobile phone a text message with a 4-digit code or a 7-digit code. You type that code in, and then you can reset your password. Like, you're free to do it. So they gained control of his Twitter account, his Gmail account, and later on he realized he had a Bitcoin account.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he's a tech journalist, so he signed up for this Bitcoin account, and he totally forgot that it even existed. He totally forgot it. And he just had no idea, and it was associated with his Gmail account. So they were obviously, or his Twitter account, or one of those. So they were obviously looking to get into this Bitcoin account, but when they got into his cell phone, they got his Gmail, they got his Twitter, they got his Bitcoin account, which had nothing in it, by the way. But because his Gmail was associated with his bank account, they then got into his bank account. And they transferred $25,000 to the Bitcoin account to where they could buy Bitcoin. Now, the banking industry in America stopped the transfer. They're like, this is very unusual. We need to investigate it. So they stopped the transfer. So he didn't lose the $25,000. And it took him over a week to get his Gmail account back and his Twitter account back. And, but holy God, Tony, he had a document in his Google Drive called... It called it a I love you letter or a love you letter or something. And it was a letter to his wife.
In case something ever happened to him.
Something ever happened to him. And it had all his usernames and all of his passwords to all of his accounts.
You know, I even at work for this kind of stuff, you need to have all this stuff backed up. But you really, what you have to do, it's pretty simple. You had all your core systems. I would say maybe quarterly, depends on how often you change your passwords, either twice a year or quarterly. You got to print the stuff out. I usually do IP address, username, password, print it out on a piece of paper, seal it in an envelope, go to the head of school's office, put it in a safe.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great idea. And if you're personal,
I was just going to say for personal stuff, and my wife and I just talked about this. Same thing, except we're going to put it in the safety deposit box at a bank.
Yeah, there was on ZDNet, one of the comments, and the guy was really douchey about it. He's like, you're an idiot. You deserve everything you got. I back up everything in my life on a hard external hard drive, and then I put it into a safe deposit box twice a month. So he's like swapping out, I guess, external hard drives to do this. But that's a little too much, you know. But this guy trusted everything onto the cloud. He trusted Google. He trusted Twitter. Now, he's a tech journalist, so Twitter is really important to him. And he had about 12,000 followers, and now he's down to 3. And he's like, I'm never going to get back those who have lost. Maybe some of them, but not most of them, because they knew that this was a fake account. Like, they had heard through the grapevine, and they just dropped me. They stopped following me. And so that's going to hurt his livelihood. That's going to hurt his reputation. But at the same time, he put everything into Google, everything into a single cloud account. Everything.
I don't know. Like, it's hard. Like, my wife and I are always like, where'd you put it? Because we split stuff up. Like, we've got things in different places. I have some stuff on an FTP server. Like, I don't know. Like, we try to back stuff up on external hard drives, but I think we're actually getting to a point where we're going to be doing documents in a safety deposit box and a couple external hard drives in a safety deposit box. That's what I just like would recommend. I think it's the only like smart thing to do. If somebody hacks my browser and they get, I don't really have a lot of financial stuff stored, for people to get. I try to keep that stuff clear, but it's hard. You pay for something sometimes and you save it.
Yeah, and he was paying for Google storage. He was paying for Google Drive storage, you know.
So I don't know. I feel bad for the dude, but the phone thing, the SIM card,
Yeah. And
I do think that's a little weird though.
no, so here's the thing. So it got hacked the first time. So he called T-Mobile and he got it, and they're like, okay. He's like, this is a hack. You need to stop whatever they is. And he was able to prove to whatever degree that T-Mobile wanted that this was a hack. And then he had to go travel. He had to travel for a job. And so he was out of cell phone range. And it turns out he got like an email from his wife or something going, hey, something weird is happening. You need to like call me. And so he went, like, he had to drive from wherever he was, like an hour to cell phone range. And as soon as he got in cell phone range, sure enough, his SIM on his phone said, oh, your SIM has been deactivated. And then he had to use, various different channels. But his SIM got hacked twice. So it didn't just happen one time. It happened another, like, it got hacked. It got reverted back. The hackers are like, well, let's try it again. And it worked again. I mean,
That's weird.
that's insane. And that was T-Mobile. He reached out to somebody high up, an executive at T-Mobile. He didn't name the person in the article. But he reached out to somebody and he goes, please, please put a hold on my account that nobody can make any changes unless it's from me or, but T-Mobile, when he asked him the first time, can you not do this? And they're like, I'm sorry. He goes, what if the T-Mobile representative said, well, what if you're nowhere near a T-Mobile store and you need T-Mobile assistance on this level? We can't put a hold on your account because of that. And they're like, we're really, really, really sorry, but this is our policy. And I don't know. It was just, it's interesting. Usually you have people who have terrible, terrible passwords that are getting hacked. But here is a guy who they hacked his two-factor authentication and used it against him. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, I'm really paranoid. I mean, I check my credit card, literally like once a week. I log in and check everything that's posted to it. I have notices set up. Anytime I get anything that says something about a device accessing my account, I stop and check it. Most of the time, it's like me, but I still do it. Yeah, I don't know. I think some of this two-factor authentication stuff isn't, it's good, except for the fact that if somebody gets a hold of your phone, your phone is just a key to unlock it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there were some suggestions using, instead of your cell phone number, using something like Google Authenticator, which is an app that Google offers. And it doesn't just work with Google, by the way. It'll work with quite a number of services. Google awful damn it. Google also offers something like a USB key. An encrypted USB key that you can plug in that'll give you some information to unlock your stuff. There are other opportunities. There are other opportunities, but it's just, yeah. Don't trust it all in one place. It's kind of the thing.
Yep, don't do it.
Yeah.
And there's a reason that wills are usually kept in a lawyer's office in a safe. So
Yeah.
consider.
There you go. So I'm gonna move on here to privacy, Tony, if you will. So I heard about this article from This Week in Technology, Leo Laporte's show. It's good. It was a good one, and it's a blog post called "The New Wilderness" from idlewords.com. And idlewords.com is a blog site written by the person who created Pinboard. And Pinboard is a social bookmarking site for introverts.
Oh.
Anyway, it's super cheap. I think it's just a way for you can bookmark sites and then share them with only people you want, and the people who run Pinboard have no idea what you're sharing. I think that's what it is.
It sounds a lot like Delicious from the early 2000s.
Too bad Delicious was bought by Yahoo and then shut down. Yeah, just completely destroyed. And anyway, there's a quote I'm going to read here. Out of all of it, it's an interesting article. I don't know if I agree with everything, but I'm going to read one quote here. And this is a bit lengthy, so bear with me. Quote, "I'll call it ambient privacy, the understanding that there is value in having our everyday interactions with one another remain outside the reach of monitoring, and the small details of our daily lives should pass by unremembered, period. What we do at home, work, church, school, or in our leisure time does not belong in a permanent record, period. Not every conversation needs to be a deposition, period." End of quote.
Yeah, that's good.
That's great, isn't it? Now, the only way to achieve this, Tony, that I could see, is to get off social media.
Agreed.
I mean, that's it. That's the only way. You cannot trust social media. I don't understand. I don't get it. These people are outraged at Twitter and at Facebook and at Instagram and at WhatsApp and WeChat or Line or whatever it is, or Kakao, and expect them to change when their business model the business model is, we need your information to sell to advertisers to make money.
Yeah, I think a lot of the Asian apps are just better. There's not as much controversy because the privacy rules are different, and a lot of those apps are kind of built where businesses are participating. So the business uses the app as like their cash point and stuff, and that's how their money's made. So like, they don't need to sell ads because they built an infrastructure that allows businesses to use their software to conduct business. And I think that's a huge difference between what's happening in North America, where it's all basically built around just driving up people to fight and argue so they can drive traffic.
I agree with you.
I think he's right. Like disconnecting more, especially at home, and I would even say in the office. I mean, you shouldn't have to, every single thing that you do and say shouldn't be recorded. And because out of context, a lot of the stuff that we do and say would look really bad.
Yeah, it would look terrible. Get people fired, destroy their lives. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, we've just moved back, from overseas, and I'm just thinking about, do we need Facebook anymore? I mean, why were we using it? Mostly because we were overseas. For our child, we're using a paid private photo sharing app. We're not putting anything on Facebook.
Yeah.
So all of our family photos are in a paid private space. And, it's like $50 a year. That's what we're paying to share our babies' like moments with our friends and family. But, in the future, I don't think that's going to, no one's going to be able to monetize that. So it's good. I mean, I think it's worth it. I pay for Google storage, mostly for photos, for archiving photos at high resolution.
Yep.
It was the best deal, I could find. And when you pay for stuff with Google, they don't sell it. That's what I think a lot of people don't understand. You know, when you're spending money, it's yours.
Yeah.
It's when you're using free stuff that you're giving it all away.
Yeah. And I know this is say with G Suite Education or G Suite Business or whatever. They're like, oh, we don't, you know, we're not selling that information to advertising. That doesn't mean they're not capturing that that information in your demographics and selling that information to advertising. They might not be selling you specifically. So I think that's a good point to put in there. But no, I saw it was very, very, very telling. It's just very interesting. Concept, ambient privacy.
I think there's more people like that than people realize, and they just don't know how to do it. And I think it's a very small percentage of people who are, you know, out there screaming and driving up attention every day. Unfortunately, it just seems like a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you're busy, I mean, I don't know, if you're really busy, you just don't have time to, like, I literally don't have any time to use Twitter.
Yeah.
I've no time to use it for anything, and I have no need to use it.
And you know, you and I, Tony, we listened to a particular podcast, and on one podcast, they had a person write in talking about Twitter. And they said that the number of actual active accounts versus the number of actually used accounts are huge, significantly different.
Only like 5% of accounts are actually used.
Yeah. Out of hundreds of millions.
Original content. So, I don't know. I think I'm hoping that it comes to a head soon and people really start, you know, shutting it off and making a switch. I think there's a market. You know, we paid $50 to have all these photos. When we're done, when we close it down, they'll produce an album that will, the data will be deleted and we'll have physical photos if we want, or we can download all the photos. I think there's a market for a lot of services like that at a small price point, but a lot of the services, you know, for people.
I think,
because you don't have to use them for your whole life. I mean, you just pay, use it, and when you're done, you shut it off.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if and I know this was early web, but if web services come back, become a thing again. I want a private email server, but I don't have the resources or the hardware to host it in my home. Can I host it here? And I know it's secure.
Right,
kind of a deal. I think the next 10-15 years are going to be very, very interesting in this space, and I look to see what happens with it. I'm very, very anxious.
Well, I might check out Pinboard because I really did like Delicious.
Yeah, Delicious was so good. It was so good, and yeah. So check out Pinboard. I haven't really checked it out too much. I just know it's pinboard.in, folks, if you want to check it out. Not www.pinboard.in, just pinboard.in.
Do it.
Check it out. Yeah, it's you can sign up for $11 a year. So you're talking what? I mean, it's not even a dollar a year, folks. That's pretty.
Look, if you just skip two Starbucks and you're done.
Yeah, and hold on here. I'm just going to read from there, and their site is nothing special. It says, Pinboard lets you bookmark from any browser, connect up to 3 Twitter accounts and favorites, and sync with popular services like Instapaper or Pocket. There you go. For a few more bucks a year, Pinboard offers an archiving service, which saves a copy of everything you bookmark, gives you full text search, and automatically checks your account for dead links.
Cool.
Hey, there you go. And so I think you might even be able to sign up for free if you want to. It's quite simple. But anyway, that's the guy who wrote the New Wilderness article on idlewords.com. So,
all right, we're running low on time, Patrick.
We are.
You've got one more topic.
I got one more, and Tony, have you been depressed? Yeah. Are you online and depressed?
I don't feel like I get depressed, like, Tony, when I see people like eating sometimes, like at food courts.
Well, you, sir, then need to start an Instagram page about this. You need to.
Will that help me?
Well, maybe not, but it might help you make some money. Apparently, being depressed and online is a very popular thing. And Mashable. Now, folks, Mashable.com. It's mostly lip service. They're like, hey, look at this. This new show is on Netflix. Whoa, it's good. You should watch it. I don't care if it's good or not, but you should watch it because Netflix paid us. Or it's online, or they have an online presence, and we don't want to upset Netflix or Disney or whatever. Anyway, or we don't want to upset, you know, Chris, you know, this influencer or that influencer. Anyway, so they wrote an article called Depression, Social Media, Sad Online. Let me get it here. How Being Sad, Depressed, and Anxious Online Became Trendy by Jess Joho. And you know what? This is like a real freaking article. This is like a real, we're talking thousands of words here about how people who have made a name for themselves being depressed online, whether it be Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, whatever, just being depressed online apparently is trendy. You know what, Antoni?
So people just follow and read the depressive information, the comments and stuff?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. So, Tony, I did an experiment. This was years ago, before the IT Babble blog even existed, before IT Babble podcast even existed. Do you want to hear about it?
Go ahead.
All right. Here we go. I was in Kuwait, and a colleague of mine, he was laughing at one of his friends. I'm putting this in quote, Facebook friends, okay? One of his friends' Facebook posts. And I was like, what is it? And he goes, this guy has like 4,000 friends. I was like, hold on here. How does this guy have 4,000 friends? This is like 2008, okay? So pretty early, yeah. pretty early when Facebook was live. I was like, how's this guy have 4,000 friends? He goes, well, all he does is he posts depressing stuff about his life all day. Like, for example, He wrote, oh, I spilled coffee on my pants. Par for the course. Maybe I should just kill myself.
What?
I'm not saying suicide should be laughed at. But this is what this guy would post like 5 or 6 times a day. 5 or 6 times a day. He would be like, oh, I was just filling out a report for my boss. My pencil broke. Figure, par for the course. Or you know, like I needed to make a copy of an expense report. Copier's out of toner. I guess I'm going to get yelled at by my boss. You know, stuff like this. Stuff like this. So I did an experiment. I did an experiment, Tony, when I was on Facebook. For 2 weeks, I posted nothing but depressing stuff.
And what happened?
What do you think happened? What do you think happened? Give people me a prediction.
People were just all over your wall.
Yes.
And commenting.
Yes. Yes. All of a sudden, I got tons of information. Instead of like, hey, check out a great picture of my wife and I. Or it was like, are you okay? Do you need help? What's going on? Can you talk to me about this? This doesn't sound like you. This, you know, I mean, for 2 weeks, I got like 5 times more responses out of my Facebook pages than I did when I was happy. Depression sells. Depression, people want to help. Depression, people want to reach out. It's obvious that it became a business, that it became trendy, that it became an Instagram kind of theme or meme or whatever you want to call it. And so this Mashable article kind of calls that out. They're like, this is, you know, people who are really depressed, but people who are depressed online, this is terrible. This is bad. This is making things bad. And if you are depressed, then online is not the place you should go.
No. People are just going to feed it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I never knew about that experiment. That's pretty interesting, Patrick.
Yeah, 2 weeks. And I got tons and tons. I mean, tons. Well, tons. When I would post something on Facebook, I get nothing.
Had.
Yeah, yeah. I get like 4 or 5 things per post. And it would be something simple like, The sun's out today, but sure feels like a cloud is over my head. Oh, sigh. And then people are like, hey, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on in your life? What's it? Yeah, is it work?
Normally, like, if you post something normal, you just get like a thumbs up or a smiley face. Yeah. No one actually says anything.
No, no, but here I'm getting messages back. My principal says I'm doing a good job teaching. I just don't feel it. I think I'm doing a terrible job. Maybe I picked the wrong profession. People are like, yeah. No. And then people are like, no, you're a great educator. You know? But I could see, you know, people just making business and selling off. I mean, you go to Instagram and you can find all sorts of depression stuff. Like a shirt to say, I'm depressed. I'm not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, oh. And this isn't new. This isn't new at all. This is something that's been around for a while. And so,
but I think you're right. I think people are monetizing a lot of negative content right now.
Yes, and, absolutely.
Not,
yeah.
You know, it's not good for kids either. I had a conversation with a teenager. I'm not going to get anything too political on our podcast, but he was talking to me about something, you know, that was political. And I was like, well, you know what happened, right? And I went through this like thing with him about, it had to do with the election. That's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to go into details. But there was some very unbiased data on this particular situation. And I'm like, you can look these numbers up. No one's going to dispute them. This is actually what happened. And I'm like, imagine, you know, I gave him another scenario. I'm like, imagine if that had happened, like, with, like, two sports teams. You know, how would you have felt about that? And he's like, oh, that would be totally unfair. I'm like, I know. He was like, oh, I never really thought about it like that. I'm like, because you're smart, but you didn't take even a moment to just look at the numbers and ask where they came from. You were looking at the numbers, and the numbers were correct, but the comments about the numbers weren't correct. And, you know, the outrage about this particular set of data was just outrage. No one even paid attention to it. They're just like, oh, yeah, you know, this is wrong. It's like, did you read it? And it's really easy to jump in, you know, it's really easy to pile on, and it feels good because you're not by yourself. It's hard to say, I know everybody's really excited about this, but I need like some time to read it. That's the problem,
yeah.
You know? And, I don't know. When I was doing my PTC course, especially in the leadership course, there was like one day we were going over something to do with like staff and teacher evaluations. And they said, you know, there's always one staff member whose cat dies every day. And
I love cats. And when my cat died, I was in,
no matter what happens, every time you need them to do something, there's going to be not an excuse, but a horrible situation every time. And, it's going to seem statistically impossible because it is. And I think that's the other thing you need to realize. Like, it's almost impossible for a person to have that day every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
That day they're writing about, it's just really not possible. People who are having days like that every day, they're not on Twitter. They're probably not even online.
No.
If you travel enough and you see, you know, the world, you know what real, like, depressive scenarios look like. And they don't look like people on their phones messaging about how sad they are.
Yeah, and there's a differentiation between, a depressive scenario or depressive part of somebody's life and somebody battling depression. And if somebody is online trying to sell you depression, they're not depressed. They're a capitalist, and they're trying to make money off of what you are feeling. And you should go talk to somebody or reach out to people. You shouldn't. Yeah. It's just bad. And I'm reading a book right now, and they're talking about like the uptick in depression. But then when I read that book and then I read this article, I'm just like, how much of that is actually depression or somebody saying they're depressed or somebody who feels I'm social media depressed instead of actually like, depressed.
If people aren't up on their South Park, go find the episodes with Cartman when he gets a note from the doctor so he can wear his Buddha box on his head every day. Okay. Just start that was perfect. And that's exactly what we're talking about. So it's worth looking. Cartman gets a note saying he has anxiety from his doctor, and he gets to wear a box on his head that basically creates a massive virtual projection of his phone. And it has noise-canceling headphones, so he can use his phone and not hear the world and just walk around in school all day with the Buddha box on. So, that's kind of what we're talking about.
All right. I am putting a link in the – in fact, there's a Wikipedia link, folks, called Buddha Box.
Yeah.
And I figure that's a good place to end the show.
Yeah. I've actually asked students if they want me to build something like that for them.
That sounds like awesome.
Do you want your Buddha box? Yeah.
So,
all right. Yeah, I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to call this episode 167, even though 166 is still kind of, I don't know, maybe it'll show up eventually. It was a fun one, but 166, that's a pretty good one. It's a really good one, actually. And you can order your Buddha box from TonyDePreto.com. There's only $4.99 for a Buddha box custom to you. So, get on there, TonyDePreto.com, and order your own Buddha box.
Yeah, send me the money, and I'll send you a cardboard box that you can put over your head.
A Buddha box. It's fantastic. $4.99. Or you can buy three. You can buy three for $2,000. How about that savings? All right. So my math isn't so good. All right. Anyway, for IT Babble, I'm Patrick.
And I'm Tony.
And we will catch you on the next episode. So keep on babbling out there.